Last week, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder offered this defense of the U.S. killing American citizens suspected of terrorism without a trial.
Some have argued that the president is required to get permission from a federal court before taking action against a United States citizen who is a senior operational leader of Al-Qaeda or associated forces. This is simply not accurate. Due process and judicial process are not one and the same, particularly when it comes to national security. The Constitution guarantees due process. It does not guarantee judicial process.
That's U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder speaking at Northwestern University's law school last week, making a distinction between due process and judicial process when it comes to U.S. citizens like Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen, accused of being terrorist leaders. Now, you might be surprised to hear that if you remember President Obama's pledge to close Guantanamo or his defense of habeas corpus as a law professor or his criticisms of Bush administration policies when Obama was in the Senate or running for the presidency. Well, don't be surprised. Jack Goldsmith is with us now. He is a professor of law at Harvard who served in the Bush administration's Office of Legal Counsel. He is now the author of Power and Constraint, The Accountable Presidency After 9/11. Mr. Goldsmith, welcome to WNYC. Thank you very much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me on.
And for listeners who aren't familiar with you, would you just take a minute and talk about your history in the Bush administration? You wrote a book about it called The Terror Presidency. People may have heard you, you know, on that book tour. But just give us a little background on your role when you headed the Office of Legal Counsel, particularly in debates in the war on terror, and why you left the post.
Right. I was served for a year in the Defense Department as a lawyer there. And then I served as the head of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department, and that is the branch of the Justice Department that rules on the legality of executive branch action inside the government, and especially the war on terrorism. My book, The Terror Presidency, was basically a memoir of my time in government, an explanation of why I did some controversial things in withdrawing some memos that I thought lacked legal support and trying to put them on firmer legal ground. So it was a reflection on that and also on the many challenges that the executive branch faces in trying to balance compliance with the law with keeping the country safe. So that's what my first book was about.
Is it accurate to say you were an architect of what came to be known to its critics, the Bush administration's torture policies, and then became a dissident from them?
No, that's not accurate. I wasn't in the government when the torture policies were, I wouldn't even call them torture policies, when the interrogation policies were devised. I inherited them when I got in the Justice Department, and I withdrew what I thought were some of the more extreme legal claims and tried to put it on a sounder footing.
So getting back to Eric Holder's speech and the clip we just played on due process versus judicial process when it comes to killing American citizens who are suspected terrorists or terrorist leaders. Is that a meaningful distinction to you between due process and judicial process that he was trying to draw?
I don't think it was as artfully put as it could have been, but yes, I do think it's an accurate distinction. The Constitution guarantees due process of law. The Supreme Court has made clear that what due process requires depends on the context. The Supreme Court has also made clear that the president, when he's authorized by Congress to exercise his full war powers, can do so, and that, at least in other contexts, American citizenship is no bar to the exercise of the commander-in-chief's powers. Moreover, it's not even clear how this case would go to court to be reviewed. There's a lot of discussion about having courts review these decisions, which have always traditionally been made by the president. But the ACLU brought a lawsuit challenging this power, and the court ruled that it didn't have the power to rule on it, that the Constitution itself left decisions about targeting during war, even of American citizens, to the political branches. Political branches that I might add, it's not just the president deciding this on his own. He's got an elaborate bureaucracy with lots of lawyers looking at it. looking at judicial decisions about the constraints and the scope of their powers, and also consulting with and reporting to Congress on these issues.
So in the context of your idea of the accountable presidency, which is the title of your new book, do you see President Obama's policies as having shifted in this direction since the time he was candidate Obama or Senator Obama?
There's no doubt that he continued almost all of the Bush policies, and indeed on the drone program, he ramped up the drone program from what Bush's baseline was. And there's no doubt that his continuation of almost all of the Bush policies was a surprise, probably the biggest surprise of his administration, because he had on the campaign trail made a big deal of the fact that he was going to change those policies. Now, as I go through in the book, when you read through what he actually said, he left himself lots of careful wiggle room. But as I also explain in the book, what Obama didn't talk about on the campaign trail was the fact that the other institutions of our government and the press and civil society had pushed back really hard against Bush between 2002 and 2009 and altered and tinkered with and ultimately approved all of those policies in ways that Barack Obama inherited in 2009. So most of the policies that he was criticizing had already been changed and approved, including by Obama himself, for example, who voted in 2008 to alter the president's surveillance powers. So he was really arguing against a straw man on the campaign trail, and when he assumed the responsibilities of the presidency and had all these legal authorities, he wasn't about to walk away from them.
So let's dial back the clock a little bit and play another clip of candidate Obama as we knew him in 2008. He had been a law professor who had defended habeas corpus, the right to appeal the basis of your arrest, even in these cases of detention in the war on terror. As a senator, he was cheered by civil libertarians. So here he is from a 2008 CNN debate discussing habeas corpus.
Our legitimacy is reduced when we've got a Guantanamo that is open, when we suspend habeas corpus. Those kinds of things erode our moral claims that we are acting on behalf of broader universal principles. And that's one of the reasons why those kinds of issues are so important.
So, Jack Goldsmith, what happened? Is the view from the Oval Office really so different that it changed candidate Obama's mind?
Well, a couple of things happened. First of all, I don't know when in 2008 he made that speech, but he's right that Congress and the president had suspended the writ or not extended the writ to Guantanamo. The writ of habeas corpus, for your listeners, is the judicial process that allows someone to challenge the legality of their detention by the executive. And he's right in saying that it did not extend to Gitmo, but the courts in the summer of 2008 ruled as a matter of constitutional law that habeas corpus did extend to Guantanamo. And so when he came, and he wanted, there's no doubt that Obama wanted to close Gitmo. When he came into office, however, and he took steps to try to close Gitmo, the Congress pushed back. The Congress is what has prevented Obama from closing Gitmo. The president to this day says that he would like to close Gitmo, but overwhelming bipartisan majorities in Congress have said Gitmo has to stay open and that the president is not allowed to try the Gitmo detainees in civilian courts. Now, what's interesting about that is the same forces that pushed Bush to the right against his will also prevented Obama from going to the left more than he wanted to.
The same forces or different forces?
It's Congress and the courts in legitimizing certain policies, and then Congress in telling the president what he had to do, in both cases pushed the presidents to places where they didn't want to go. And actually, in both cases, it was bipartisan, large majorities of Congress. And so, for example, it was Senator Carl Levin who led the most recent laws to make sure that Gitmo would not be closed and that the president could not try civilians in Gitmo detainees in civilian court in the United States. So what's remarkable is you have presidents with as different as Bush and Obama, with two very different philosophies and different attitudes towards their powers and what they want to accomplish, and they end up in about the same place, many times against their will. And what this evidences is what I'm talking about in my book, that there are larger forces here, constitutional forces from the Congress and the courts, the people, the press, civil society. The president doesn't operate in a free space. He's deeply constrained and shaped by these other institutions. I'm not saying the president doesn't have lots of power. He clearly does, but he's constrained and guided much more than we realize.
My guest is Jack Goldsmith, who was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Bush administration, now teaches law at Harvard and is the author of Power and Constraint, The Accountable Presidency After 9/11, arguing that Bush and Obama have been pushed more toward each other on detention policies in particular and other kinds of war policies because of these external pressures. And we can take your phone calls for him if a few people want to call in at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And I guess to help back up your point that it's not for lack of trying to close Guantanamo on President Obama's part, here is a clip, now a historical clip, of the president signing the executive order that he issued to close Guantanamo Bay on just his third day in office, January 22nd, 2009.
This first executive order that we are signing by the authority vested in me as president by the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America, in order to effect the appropriate disposition of individuals currently detained by the Department of Defense at Guantanamo, and promptly to close the detention facility at Guantanamo consistent with the national security and foreign policy interests of the United States and the interests of justice, I hereby order. And we then provide the process whereby Guantanamo will be closed no later than 1 year from now.
And that was more than 3 years ago. Mike in Washington Heights, you're on WNYC with Jack Goldsmith. Hello.
Hi. I just had one point, but now actually a second one. One is the claim that all the policies were modified and approved is not quite accurate. The Supreme Court ruled against the Bush administration twice, once that Guantanamo did come under U.S. jurisdiction, the laws, and two, the rights of prisoners in habeas corpus. The other thing is that the other is a common point that presidents, when they come into office and find they have these powers, are reluctant to give them up, that once a president gains certain powers, rightly or wrongly, they remain.
Mike, thank you very much. So on the Supreme Court and the Bush administration, Jack?
No, I didn't say that the Bush administration won every case in the Supreme Court. And in fact, those cases that the caller was talking about are cases where the court pushed back against the Bush administration, but they pushed back in a way that led there to be judicial review of Gitmo and led the lower courts to approve and put the cloak of judicial approval over detentions in Gitmo. So that was an example where the president was pushed back, the standards of detention were raised, there was closer judicial scrutiny, but in the end, it was legitimized and approved by the courts.
Do you think that President Bush succeeded in expanding the powers of the presidency, which I think was one of his goals in the post-9/11 era?
It was one of his goals in the post-9/11 era. It's hard to measure. I think that the answer is no, he did not expand them in the ways that he wanted. He did in his early years, as many presidents do at the beginning of a war, Roosevelt and Lincoln, for example, mark out a lot of space of unilateral presidential power. But what he invited was an unprecedented pushback and the imposition of an accountability system that is the opposite of what he wanted and what he ended up invited and having. So I think that he certainly didn't achieve the type of presidential power he wanted. There's no doubt we live in a world of massive presidential power, endless war, huge national security bureaucracy. That's taken. That's a given. What I try to talk about in my book is that there's been, on the other side of that, we've had a huge accountability system grow up. And the reason that we have a political and legal consensus in favor of almost all the counterterrorism policies now is because that accountability system has changed and then has changed, bless those policies.
Su Yang in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. My question is, you know, there's been a lot of debate lately about the legality of the president authorizing assassinations of Americans deemed as enemy combatants. But what about foreigners? I mean, what about the legality of drone strikes? I mean, we kill people we think of as enemy combatants, but we also kill civilians, we also kill their families and their children. So does it make a difference that they're Americans or not?
thank you for raising the question. And I think there's a moral question here and there's a legal question here, Jack. And one of them is there a legal distinction between killing American citizens on foreign soil suspected of being terrorists and killing foreign nationals suspected of doing the same things, with, of course, the collateral damage, as they call it, the inadvertent deaths that come along with things like drone strikes?
There is a legal distinction. The moral issues are very hard, but there is a legal distinction, and the basic legal distinction is that the Constitution protects U.S. citizens abroad outside the United States in the ways that it doesn't protect non-citizens, and that's long been the rule of constitutional law. Let me just say that targeted killing, no one thinks this is an easy issue, especially targeted killing of Americans, but targeted killings generally. But it's not, first of all, it's not accurate to call it assassination. Assassination is an unlawful killing, and these killings are fully authorized by the Congress of the United States in ways that were reaffirmed last December. The president takes, and the executive branch takes, precautions and has legal constraints, elaborate legal constraints on the use of these unprecedentedly precise weapons. The people that don't think that we should be engaged in so-called targeted killing, I think, are people that don't think we should be at war, which both the courts and Congress and the president think we are, because that's what one does in war. One finds and kills the enemy, and that's what's going on in this war.
You said earlier that the Obama administration has gone beyond the parameters that the Bush administration had set for itself with respect to drone killings. Were those parameters in writing? Was there a moral sense in them that pressing a button somewhere in Utah and taking the risk of killing innocent families because you can't see where you're aiming or whatever was somehow out of bounds beyond a certain point at that time?
No, that's not what I meant. All I meant was, I think they're using basically the same legal authorities. What I meant was is that the number and scope of drone strikes has ramped up significantly under Bush. Under Obama. Bush, the late Bush administration in the last year, started to rely on drone strikes more as a substitute for both detention and for having a big military footprint. And the Obama administration accelerated that process. And so that's what I meant to say. I didn't mean to say that they'd expanded the legal authorities, because I don't believe they have.
Joel in Union, you're on WNYC. Hello, Joel.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. I'm just wondering how much President Obama feels constrained by pressure from the military, often anonymous pressure, or pressure that doesn't get reported. It seems as though he was playing up to them when he insisted that the Afghan war was a good war in his campaign, and now it's, of course, turned sour, and we seem trapped in it. And on and on. I mean, he's such a great disappointment for those of us who were thinking of decreasing our footprint in the world. And of course, this inspires terrorism and hatred of us.
So your question is how much
establishment that wants to keep its job and keep the money flowing. What do you think about this?
Well, first of all, I would say that President Obama has been. You're right that he extended and indeed ramped up our presence in Afghanistan. Now he's drawing it down. He significantly reduced our presence in Iraq, as he promised. Look, there's no doubt that the military is a giant bureaucracy with lots of influence on the presidency. And Bob Woodward wrote a book about the influences on Obama, and there was a lot of pressure in the military to increase the footprint in 2009 in Afghanistan. But I don't think there's much evidence that Obama is being constrained by the military in ways that he really doesn't want to go. And so I just don't think there's much of a basis for that.
So before you go, one of the areas in which you write that there has been a big change from Bush to Obama is in the area of interrogation. You call this the biggest and most important change. The CIA has been pulled almost entirely out of the interrogation business. Waterboarding has been redefined as torture. There are criminal investigations of excessive CIA interrogations. Why is this the area of most distinction?
Well, it's the area of most distinction because it's where he came in and he actually ended something that was going on. It's really the only area, CIA interrogation and black site torture, that Obama ended the prior policy. as I say in the book, it's not as big of a change as it seemed, because those programs had been dying in the last couple of years under the Bush administration, and basically Obama came in and officially put them out of their misery. But there's no doubt, remember in 2009 when he did this and when he revealed the legal memos to the CIA, he caught a lot of heat for that from the right, from Cheney and others on the right. And so I think it's fair to say that that was a strong departure from what Bush was doing. It's also true, however, that those policies were dying because Congress had earlier, years earlier, pushed far back against what Bush had done and narrowed his authorities, and the courts had as well. So there were other forces at work, but Obama came in and finished the job on that.
So on these areas that you write about and the ones we've been talking about, interrogation, detention, drones, killings of U.S. nationals or others, do you think there would be much of a difference in the next 4 years whether President Obama is reelected or Mitt Romney, presumably, as the Republican nominee, is elected?
I really don't think that there will be much of a difference. One of the lessons of Barack Obama coming in and continuing Bush's policies is that there are these larger forces at work. I quote a 34-year-old CIA veteran in the book who said that he's seen many administrations come and go. They all come in promising to dramatically change the national security posture, and they get in office, and they have the responsibilities of the presidency, and they're constrained by many factors, and they just don't have the same type of discretion that they think they have. So there are larger forces at work here that are setting U.S. counterterrorism policy other than the inclinations of the president of the United States. I wouldn't expect much of a radical change no matter who the next president is.
Jack Goldsmith, he headed the Office of Legal Counsel in the Bush administration. He teaches law at Harvard now, and his new book is called Power and Constraint, The Accountable Presidency After 9/11. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Life Inside the Brackets, How the NCAA Exploits Student Athletes, and What Might Be Done About It. Stay with us.